This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We now have a recent report of massacres this year in the Amhara region, where, you know, the Abiy administration is going after the Fano militia in that area.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, on the civil war in Ethiopia's northern Amhara region. Details coming up. Also, an Egyptian lawyer paves the way for expanded women's rights. And Zimbabwe's government pushes back on new U.S. sanctions. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Yesterday, as we reported, was the most consequential day so far in the U.S. presidential race for both the Democratic and Republican parties, a day political junkies have labeled Super Tuesday. 15 states and one U.S. territory held presidential nominating contests in some form or another and awarded more than one-third of the total delegates available in one day. Today, we have online VOA's national correspondent, Steve Herman, to update us on the results. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Steve.
A pleasure to be here.
So it looks like Biden and Trump dominated Tuesday's primaries.
They not only dominated, but they have cleared the way for themselves to be on a glide path to renominations at their respective party conventions later in the summer, after essentially vanquishing any potential serious opponents.
Talking about vanquishing, talk to us about the exit from the contest of Nikki Haley. Who was she and what happened?
Yes, this wasn't a huge surprise. Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina and who was ambassador to the United Nations during the Trump administration, was the last candidate still standing to try to take out Trump from getting the nomination. She won only one small state last night on Super Tuesday, the state of Vermont. And it was clear from yesterday's trouncing that Trump probably by next week will have enough delegates to clinch the nomination. She wished him well, but she did not endorse him, saying that Trump needs to earn the trust of the voters that supported her.
So moving forward, what should we be expecting from the frontrunners in the next days, weeks, and months?
Well, they are pretty much now targeting each other. I thought it was interesting that in the past hour, we've had statements issued by President Biden and former President Trump, both essentially trying to court Nikki Haley's voters, because if this is a very close election, these sort of independent-minded voters, or those that are not so sure about Trump or not enthusiastic about Biden, which way they swing could determine whether Biden is reelected or Trump returns as president in 2025 after the 2024 November election.
VOA's national correspondent Steve Herman, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
President Joe Biden's administration has begun to take a more assertive tone with Israel over its war with Hamas, calling for a significant increase in aid access and for Israel to agree to a ceasefire. However, a recent survey of Arab Americans indicates President Biden's popularity among Arab and Muslim Americans has significantly dropped over U.S. support for Israel. James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute in Washington, discussed the Biden policy and its impact on his re-election campaign with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I make the fact that they're scrambling to try to send a different message, but it is a different message without a fundamental change in policy. And until they recognize that sending weapons without conditioning aid to Israel, without putting a firm no in the place of Israel's continued behavior, then nothing will change. It's impossible to imagine how you get supplies in when you, number one, have bombs dropping or troops shooting or people starving and afraid of the Israeli military on the receiving end. At the same time, it's possible that the U.S. simply tells Israel, get out of the way of the aid, leave the areas where we're sending aid, bring the trucks in without all of these cumbersome investigations that you continue to do, despite the fact that they've already been inspected on the other side of the border, and the situation would disappear. It would be much easier to work with if the Israelis weren't impeding the process. So there's a contradiction here in what is the message the U.S. wants to send and the continued support for Israel's military actions in Gaza.
Dr. Zoghbi, following your survey of Arab Americans, you said that President Biden's popularity among Arab and Muslim Americans has significantly dropped over his policy in Gaza. How would that impact his re-election campaign?
Well, it'll impact it quite seriously. The fact is that a poll showed a drop from 59% support in 2020 to 17% now. That was done in October, and I'm sure the numbers have not improved and may have worsened since then. The fact is that people are distressed, they're disappointed, and they're angry with the policy of the administration. These people will not vote for Donald Trump, but they will vote either for a third-party candidate or they won't vote at all. It's not only Arab Americans who are affected, but it's also, as our broader polling shows, it's affecting young people, it's affecting Black, Latino, and Asian voters, it's affecting young progressive Jews. And if you lose 10% of the Black, Latino, and Asian vote in several key states, you cannot win the election. What we showed in Michigan with 101,000 undecided votes, which, by the way, is the margin of victory or defeat for a presidential candidate in that state, is that people didn't want to vote for Joe Biden. And now, while you know they can dismiss it and say, oh, come November when they have a binary choice between Biden and Trump, they'll vote for Biden because Trump is worse. The reality is that we saw in 2000, we saw in 2016, that people who aren't committed to support you will either vote for a third party candidate or they won't vote at all. When we got 101,000 votes in Michigan, it wasn't just a choice between Biden and uncommitted. It was a choice between Biden and not voting at all. People had to work hard to get those 101 votes out, and they did. It may not be the same percent in every other state because there isn't the same commitment, there isn't the same organization and infrastructure in place in other states to do what was done in Michigan. But what will happen is that they won't vote at all. The turnout will be much lower. And Biden can't afford a low turnout if he's going to win this election. Trump has energy behind his campaign. Biden doesn't have energy right now behind his campaign. And if you lose the Arab vote in Michigan, if you lose some percentage of Black, Latino, Asian voters, young voters in other states, it's going to be a problem. And the campaign, the Biden campaign, has to recognize that and do something about it.
That was James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The war in Gaza, which began October 7th when Hamas militants attacked Israel, has led to more than 30,000 deaths in Gaza. Hamas still holds more than 100 Israeli hostages taken in its initial attack, which killed about 1,200 people. When Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019, he was lauded as a regional peacemaker. Now, according to David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, his reputation as a leader who could unite Ethiopia has deteriorated, and the much heralded peace deal with Eritrea has vanished. The professor also points out to me that Abiy Ahmed is caught in the middle of a protracted civil war, which could potentially destabilize not only his government, but the wider Horn of Africa region.
My thoughts are I'm very concerned because the image of Prime Minister Abiy in 2019 has really been challenged and compromised by a lot of these reports. Firstly, of a lot of the human rights abuses perpetuated by the Ethiopian army during the Tigray War and even after the November 2022 peace settlement with the Tigray region. We now have recent reports of massacres this year in the Amhara region, where, you know, the Abiy administration is going after the Fano militia in that area. And there have been reports of indiscriminate drone attacks, of mass civilian killings, of abductions and murder. So this really paints the image of, you know, Prime Minister Abiy as this reformist. And also, let's not forget that Ethiopia is the seat of the African Union. So it really raises a lot of questions around, you know, Ethiopia as a continental leader and as a model for Africa when these kind of things are happening at the seat of the African Union.
I'm glad you mentioned the war in northern Tigray region, because when Abiy ordered the military offensive then, you know, he promised that the conflict would be resolved very quickly, but the fighting left thousands dead and forced more than 1.7 million people to flee, and it fueled famine and a rise of a wave of atrocities. And that effect, the professor, is still reverberating right now because Ethiopia is struggling with significant economic, ethnic, and political challenges. So how do you get out of this?
So this is a very difficult situation. We know since the end of the Cold War that a lot of these internal civil wars with the dissolution of Soviet Union and the competition between East and West, a lot of these civil wars around the world tend to be very contentious, and they tend to last for a very long time. And Ethiopia is no exception. It's the second largest country in Africa after Nigeria. And it's bordered by Kenya, Sudan, Somalia, and Egypt. So it's a really critical state. But the challenge with Ethiopia is there's so many diverse ethnic groups, and Ethiopia has not really had a history of democracy. We had the Haile Selassie monarchy, which was toppled by a really ruthless communist dictatorship, and then even after that, we've just had a very authoritarian kind of government. So the challenge here is, will President Abiy be able to create some form of diplomatic initiative with all these different ethnic groups, religious groups that are in conflict with the central government in Addis Ababa, whether it be in Tigray, in Amhara, in the south in Oromia. But also, let's not forget that Ethiopia also faces challenges with its neighbors, with Somalia in Somaliland. We have the problem in Sudan with the border with Ethiopia. That's another challenge. And Ethiopia has also had many tensions with Sudan and Egypt over the Grand Ethiopia Renaissance Dam. So there's a lot of internal conflict, which Prime Minister Abiy will have to try to settle with the different militia and ethnic groups. But there's also a lot of other regional conflicts around Ethiopia, and a lot of those challenges, which are also very pressing on Addis Ababa.
In part two of my conversation with David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, he talks about human rights, about the fighting in the northern Amhara region, and the imposition by the federal government of a state of emergency. Tune in tomorrow. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. And you can find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs at voaafrica.com. The latest list of the top 100 most powerful businesswomen in the Middle East showcases the accomplishments of women representing 27 sectors coming from 28 different nationalities. Among those prominent women is Mona Zulfikar, an Egyptian lawyer. Reporter Angie Omar has more from Cairo.
In the world of business and leadership, women in the Middle East and North Africa have made significant achievements. The latest list of the top 100 most powerful businesswomen in the Middle East features 100 women from the region. Mona Zulfakar is an Egyptian lawyer, a founding partner, and a chairperson at the Zulfakar & Partners law firm. Forbes Middle East chose her as one of the top 100 powerful businesswomen as she has over 25 years of experience and leads the firm's banking and capital markets group. Zulfakar also chairs the executive committee.
I played a very important role in the banking law because banking and finance was sort of my specialization, you know. Also, during the period from 2003 until 2011, two terms, I served as a legal expert board member on the board of the Central Bank of Egypt. And during that period of time, I participated intensively in developing, amending the banking law twice, and the banking regulations.
Zulfakar also is an activist, particularly in the areas of human rights and women's rights, both in Egypt and globally. She has been involved in important initiatives for four decades, such as advocating for a new marriage contract, equal rights in divorce for men and women, equal rights under the nationality law, and the establishment of family courts. She has had success in significant human rights cases, including defending the Ministry of Health's ban on female genital cutting. Zulfakar has also been at the forefront of campaigns for legal reform, including the introduction of a new non-governmental organization law, non-discrimination legislation, and the establishment of the National Council for Human Rights.
We fought as a women's movement, and I played a role being a lawyer and a women's rights advocate. We, you know, worked together to advocate with, you know, civil society organizations. And since the year 2000, we had advocated establishing a National Council for Women. So I was on that. And through that, the National Council for Women and civil society organizations, we eliminated all laws discriminating. We changed them.
Recently, Zulfakar was elected to be a member and vice chair of the United Nations Human Rights Council Advisory Committee. She also serves as a member of the National Council on Human Rights in Egypt. Zulfakar has this advice for women who hope to make a significant impact on society.
It's the four P's. It's passion. You have to do what you really like and you have, you're passionate about. Do what you like to do. It's patience. It takes time. And you have to be patient. Perseverance. You have to keep at it and improve and learn more skills and develop your abilities. Don't lose hope. Never give up. The last thing is partnership. You can never succeed alone. You have to build partnerships and work with teams. Those are my four P's for success.
Zulfakar acknowledges that the journey to achieve equality in Egypt has been challenging, but she remains steadfast in her commitment to ensuring that women have equal rights in all spheres of life on par with men. For VOA Africa, this is Angie Omar reporting from Cairo.
For more on International Women's Day and women who are making a difference, check out voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe's ruling party says new United States economic sanctions on its leaders have nothing to do with human rights. The U.S. government has updated sanctions on leaders in Zimbabwe, but says they are not intended to apply to ordinary citizens. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi in Harare has the details.
The United States has ended its two-decade-old sanctions program on the top leadership of Zimbabwe's government and ruling ZANU-PF party. But Washington immediately applied newer sanctions. Larry Socha is the chargé d'affaires with the U.S. Embassy in Harare.
On March 4th, President Biden signed an executive order terminating the Zimbabwe sanctions program, which has been in effect since 2003. That same day, the U.S. Department of the Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated 11 individuals and three entities for their engagement in corruption and human rights abuses under the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act.
He told journalists today the U.S. remains firm on its support for human rights and transparency. The new sanctions impose financial restrictions and visa bans to those on the list.
The United States is committed to upholding core values of respect for human rights and responsible, transparent governance. We have expressed and continue to have concerns regarding serious cases of human rights abuses and corruption in Zimbabwe.
The United States, European Union, and other governments have long accused Zimbabwe's government of suppressing critics and opposition parties through arrests, detentions, physical abuse, and other measures. They also have said corruption and mismanagement have undermined the country's economy. Farai Marapira is the ZANU-PF Director of Information. He says the sanctions have nothing to do with human rights and corruption in Zimbabwe.
It's unfortunate that the United States government wants to continue perpetuating a lie on the reasons why they are basing the sanctions on Zimbabwe. We simply challenge them to provide evidence of any of these allegations which they say create a basis for these sanctions. The sanctions are simply an extension of the United States foreign policy, which is focused on ensuring that the neocolonialist agenda is kept up. And however, we remain with our doors open.
Political analyst Rashid Mukundu says these developments are significant, but they suggest the U.S. is maintaining its stance on Zimbabwe.
I think it's a significant shift in the sense that as many individuals and the entities have been removed from the ZIDERA list by the Biden administration. But it's not necessarily a change in the attitude of the U.S. government, which still maintains that Zimbabwe political leadership under President Emmerson Mnangagwa is corrupt, abuses human rights, and is undermining the developmental interest of the people of this country, which is a position that is valid if we look at the many cases of corruption, many cases of rights abuses that Zimbabwe has faced.
Mukundu thinks the government will continue to blame the sanctions for Zimbabwe's economic problems. And he says that a genuine dialogue between Zimbabwe and the U.S. that would set reform benchmarks would likely yield more results. The embassy's Socha says the sanctions should not be mistaken for penalties on Zimbabwe and the public. He said the new sanctions, like the old ones, target a few political elites and businesses that are linked to human rights abuses and corruption in Zimbabwe. Those sanctioned include President Emmerson Mnangagwa and Vice President Constantino Chiwenga. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinavashe from Harare, Zimbabwe.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.